the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest tomorrow on the program is going to be Yolanda York from the Social Security Administration, and she will cover the basics of Medicare and Social Security, which you need to know. It's a little more complicated than you might think, and so you need to know what your options are. You know, here on the program, we always talk about retirement planning. Funny that. But we're going to do something a little different today. Let us say you're getting ready to pass through your exit plan from working and into retirement. Do you know there are a lot of costly mistakes that can affect your retirement plans and your retirement packages? And you need to know what they are and what you should be doing in order to avoid a lot of the cost simply by a process of ignorance. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Well, you know, if you go back maybe 25, 30 years ago, this was not an issue. But along the way, it was in the 80s, or maybe it was the 90s, Congress passed a law, and they limited the amount of deductibility of a executive salary. So if you went over $1 million, corporations don't get a deduction. So let's say your salary is $2 million. The corporation can take a deduction on $1 million of your salary. They don't get a deduction for the other million. So what has happened is companies adapt. I'm always amazed. Congress comes up with laws, and guess what? Lawyers come up with ways, or companies come up with ways to circumvent them. And one way that a lot of this was circumvented is a lot of companies said, okay, we'll give you $1 million salary because you're running a Fortune 500 company, but what we're going to do is we're going to compensate you in other ways. And one of those ways was option packages. And depending on how it's set up, there's various tax ramifications of those option packages. Then they also came up with deferred comp. So let's say you work for a company, you get a salary, and at the end of the year, you meet your objective, and all of a sudden you get this bonus in December, and you say, wow, that's going to push me into a higher Obama tax bracket. And you say, you know, I'd rather not do that. So a lot of companies came up with something like called deferred compensation. So rather than receiving the bonus, it goes into a deferred compensation package. It grows tax deferred until such time you would need to draw on it at retirement. There's also other benefits that companies have come up with. Medical packages, special medical healthcare packages in retirement, life insurance. So there's a number of ways that executives get compensated today. And it's just mind-blowing in terms of the various options that companies have. And especially if you work for a larger company, high-tech company like a Google or an Apple or somebody like that, there's all kinds of different forms of compensation, John. So it's not just salary anymore. And executives need to know what packages would work best for them. And it's just something that a lot of times they get busy, they don't have the time, and there are a lot of adverse tax consequences or income down the road in retirement that are greatly affected by the choices that they make.
Well, you know, I've heard about stock options, Jim, and you'll hear about this periodically. And what's happening in a lot of cases is companies are coming up with ways to compensate their employees in ways that don't have any tax implications.
Yeah, they're trying to offer benefits. I mean, now, most companies today offer some kind of health benefit to their employees, medical insurance. Although in the year 2020, if it's a good plan, that benefit could become taxable as ordinary income to the employee. But they have health benefits. They have outplacement services. They have, as I mentioned, various forms of tax deferral. They have pension plans. A lot of companies have 401k programs. They also have maybe profit sharing plans. They're also offering financial planning and retirement planning services. Sometimes companies will offer maybe life insurance or disability insurance. Stock options is a big part of executive pay today. In fact, if you take a look at anybody that rise to a high level within a company, chances are a good majority of their compensation is going to come through their stock option program. And also they offer disability programs. So a lot of these things are tax deductible. So what the company is trying to say is make this package, because usually if you get a highly compensated executive, they get put into the Obama tax brackets of 44%. You add, for example, here in California, where the tax rates can go as high as 13.3, you add that on top of 44% federal, John, you're talking about 57% tax bracket, and that's not counting Social Security taxes of 7.65% that you pay on the first basically $118,000, and that figure is going up. And by the way, Hillary Clinton and some of the Democrats are talking about lifting the caps of Social Security, so you'd pay Social Security taxes and Medicare taxes on your earned income. Now, once you reach a certain benefit, or let's say you go beyond $118,000, depending on your bracket, you also pay a Medicare tax, and you could pay an additional roughly about 0.5% Medicare tax depending on your income. So there are a lot more complications today. And so companies are trying to do what they can, because what good does it do to pay an executive a high level of compensation when the government takes 60% of it in the form of income taxes? So you're seeing a lot more companies trying to come up with ways to compensate their executives in ways that don't create a lot of taxable income.
Okay, executive mistakes. Well, in my career, I've known a lot of executive mistakes, but I'm talking particularly about retirement. Let's go through some of these. Say you've been for a company, 10, 15, maybe longer years. You're looking at retirement. What are the important things to know? And then what are the classic mistakes that a lot of executives make?
One thing that we often hear is they assume there's no room to maneuver. In other words, okay, here's the package. Here's my benefits. That's it. Or sometimes they'll get blindsided by a lump sum. Okay, let's say you have a deferred comp pack, you have a 401k program, you may have a profit sharing program. So you have all these multiple programs and you're looking at the numbers and you're thinking, wow, that's a lot of money. And they get blindsided by the dollar amount. But the problem with the dollar amount, John, is you and I discuss so many times. In fact, we discuss this on the weekend program. Money doesn't buy what it used to in terms of income. $1 million today invested safely produces 20% of the income that it would have, let's say, 16 years ago. We've given this example many times, but $1 million in the year 2000 could have produced $80,000 of income annually in a safe investment like a treasury note. Today, that $1 million, as of Friday, would produce little over $13,000. So imagine going from $80,000 a year on $1 million to $13,000. So when you hear a big number from your company, it may not be the best thing to look at that and say, okay, I'll roll that over into an IRA. And, you know, most executives, if they've had a 401k profit sharing program, various kind of programs that companies have, their first thought is, okay, I'll take that number, I'll roll it over, and I have the money myself. You really should take a look at if your company has what is called an annuity option. And that is, if rather than taking a lump sum and rolling it over to an IRA, you get an annuity payment that you cannot outlive. In other words, the company says, all right, based on the amount of money you have here, we will give you X amount of dollars the rest of your life and to your wife or surviving spouse. So a lot of times, executives don't look at the annuity option and what their income would be and how much that would be, how much more that would be than what they could actually earn on the outside doing it themselves. And I think this is one of the big mistakes that some of these companies, because they're large, let's say you're a Fortune 500 company, you have a lot of employees, you have tens of billions of dollars invested in pension plans, they can negotiate with insurance companies and get a better deal with an insurance company than what you might be able to get on the outside yourself. Unless, you know, maybe you're a Warren Buffett type stock picker of what you can actually do in the investment markets. So really, you should do an evaluation of annuity option versus investing on your own on the outside before you make that decision to take your retirement benefits in a lump sum and roll them over into an IRA.
You know, but Jim, I would think it would be important to also know what it's really going to cost you to live. I mean, that seems to be that base plan that you're always talking about. And based on that, you'd have to decide whether you're going to go with the annuity or investment options, either of them. So there's a certain amount of pre-planning that's going on here.
Well, sure. I mean, we have always emphasized, and our listeners are probably familiar with this, but you really need to have a retirement budget, because you need to know, you know, okay, I'm spending this right now. I'm working. I've got a salary. But if I retire, what are going to be my expenses? Will you live in a different place? Will you sell your house? Are you going to move to a different state where the taxes and cost of living are going to be much different? So you really need to get a handle on what your expenses are, because if that number is larger than you anticipated, let's just make this easy. Let's just say that you're spending $100,000 a year, and looking at your retirement budget, you decide, oh gosh, if I retire, I'm only going to be able to cut my expenses back to $80,000, so I'm going to need $80,000 to live on. Well, that may make a world of difference whether you decide to take your retirement benefits in a lump sum, roll it over into an IRA, invest it on your own to try to meet those benefits, or you take an annuity option from your employer if it's offered, and take a look at that. Now, one of the problems with the annuity option, once you annuitize and take the annuity option, you can't change it. That's it. You're going to get that check for the rest of your life as long as you live. I don't care if you live to 100. You're not going to have to worry about outliving it. And your spouse will usually, you'll choose some kind of benefit also for your spouse. And so you really need to know what your expenses are. The other thing you really need to do, and we covered this on a recent program, is your medical expenses. In the case I just mentioned, let's say you decide, okay, my cost of living is going to be $80,000. Folks, you better add another $10,000 to $12,000 to that number for future medical expenses out of pocket. We talked about how, depending on your income, Medicare premiums are going up 22% next year. Their deductibles going up 23% in the year 2018. Medicare premiums are going up for everybody. So you better know what your medical expenses are. And something that we advise our clients to do in retirement planning is we advise the executive, and sometimes a lot of the companies, especially if you're executive, will pay for this, to have a comprehensive medical physical, so that when you're getting ready to retire, you really know what kind of shape you are medically, because that may determine other decisions that you're going to make in terms of what kind of Medigap insurance or Medicare, when you apply for it, what kind of Medigap insurance you're going to cover, especially if you have a medical issue that you may not be aware of, or maybe you had an issue you're dealing with. But we recommend to our clients that are getting ready to retire, they have a very comprehensive physical that they do. The other thing I think you have to think about is tax planning. Next to your medical expenses, the second biggest expense that you're going to face in retirement is one of the biggest expenses you face throughout your working career, which is the income taxes that you're going to pay to the federal government, and state income taxes as well, depending if you live in a state that has income taxes. So knowing what your tax bracket's going to be in retirement, because that's going to determine, in the case of $80,000 that I mentioned in the previous example, how much of that $80,000 is going to include federal income taxes and state income taxes. And will you be moving to another part of the country? You see this happen a lot. A lot of people worked on the East Coast. They retired down to Florida where they don't have any income taxes. The weather is nice, at least most of the part of the year. And also the cost of living is cheaper. So know what your health is. Know what your tax bracket is. Know where you're going to live. These are important decisions you should have ahead of walking into the HR office and negotiating your exit package with the company.
Now, you're talking about larger companies that usually have bigger packages and things, but they have various programs, benefit packages, and you would think that what they would do before they make some of these decisions or an ongoing review, you go into human resources or whichever office handles that in your company and see what's really available.
Well, absolutely. You should familiarize yourself with various options. Now, if you're a high-level executive, chances are when you got promoted, they might have offered some financial planning services because your income went up substantially. Maybe you got, you know, large stock options that were granted, and part of your compensation package now includes those stock options on an annual basis. But even then, you need to know, because companies will offer several stock option packages one that is more favorable to you from a tax point of view, maybe less favorable to the company. So going into HR, finding out what your various benefits are, knowing what they are in advance, is going to help you when it comes down to negotiating that exit package when you decide to retire, either voluntarily or in some cases non-voluntarily, as happens many times when a company is taken over, or you work for a company and all of a sudden we go into a recession and there are layoffs. So you really need to know those benefits in advance and know what they are.
Okay, so given all of that, there comes the day you walk into HR and you sit down and there you are. There's a certain negotiation going on. I don't know if it's a confrontation, but at least some kind of a negotiation going on. And you say?
You know, you really need to walk into HR from a non-combative point of view. It's not me versus them. Think collaboratively. And once again, you're going to get hit with a lot of numbers. And try not to get blindsided by these big numbers. I mean, as we talked about, money doesn't provide the same income that it used to, let's say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or 16 years ago. And one of the things you might want to consider, especially if, you know, you worked for a company for a long period of time, you might have known people in your department or people that worked underneath you that recently retired, you might want to talk to them. You know, call up your old buddies from work and talk to them and say, hey, how's retirement going? You know, how did the exit go? You know, did you find things that were real helpful? And find out, because sometimes an employee retires, they made some decisions they regret making and they might have made some mistakes. So, you know, interview some ex-employees. And folks, this is just a good rule of negotiation. If you're out there, never, ever be the first one to make the first offer. In other words, you don't want to walk in there and say, okay, this is what I want. Let the company make the first offer and just say, okay, Mr. Jones, given your years of service, the benefits that you've accumulated, here's what your retirement package looks like. This is what you're going to get on this. This is what you're going to get on that. We'll cover this. Let them make that offer first. Don't you go in there and say, well, I want this, this, and this. I'd be happy if I could get this. And think beyond the income and the cash payments. This is one of the big mistakes that I see in a lot of exit plans is that today, John, and this is becoming even more important, that the employee is actually better off taking an annuity option package from the company because, number one, they're never going to have to worry about outliving it. That option will be paid to you the rest of your life. So unless you think your company's about ready to go Chapter 11 and bankrupt, you know, the annuity option, and usually the annuity option is a segregated account anyway, that wouldn't change. So, you know what those options are and take a look at the annuity option if you can, rather than if they say, okay, you've got $1.4 million in your 401k, you're thinking, oh my God, I'm finally a millionaire. But folks, $1 million doesn't buy what it used to. And also, you might want to even negotiate on such other things. Like, let's say you're getting a non-voluntary retirement. So you're not age 65. You can't apply for Medicare yet. And so you don't want to be vulnerable and have to cover medical expenses yourself. You negotiate with them some kind of extension of your medical package or the ability to, on your own, carry those medical benefits if you leave the company. So everything from health insurance to life insurance. And the other thing I would say, besides not being the first one to open their mouth on negotiations, let the company make the offer first. That way you can negotiate from that point. And if you ever hear the word, no exception, okay, this is it. Don't buy that. There's always exceptions and they're always making exceptions. And finally, here's another thing. Why not ask for it? Let's say the company makes an offer and you decide that isn't really what I'm looking for. And you decide, you know, I'd like to have this. You know, let's say you're age 64. I'd like the company to cover my medical benefits till age 65 for the next 12 months until I can apply for Medicare. Why not ask for it? It never hurts. I mean, you think about it. The worst that they can say is no. And so why not ask for it? And a lot of times it's much easier for these, especially non-cash compensation sort of awards that companies can make those. And so this is a very important thing. as we said, you want to know what your benefits are prior to walking into the HR office. You want to know all the options. You want to have a physical so you know your medical condition. You also want to know what your budget's going to be, so whether you should take a lump sum or an annuity payment. You want to know where you can live. You want to know your tax bracket. All of these are going to go into helping you make a better decision, not only from exiting your company, but also in applying for Medicare and Social Security benefits. So all of those are very important to know before you make that decision to leave your employer.
Well, you know what? You mentioned, Jim, that when Congress changed the law, stock options became a big part, but there are all sorts of different stock options and they all have different consequences. So I would think knowing this is important.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the best things, there's two kinds of stock options, one called ISO, incentive stock options, NQSO, non-qualified stock options, and there are different tax treatments. And, you know, we don't have enough time to cover these. Maybe we'll cover this on another program. But obviously, ISOs are the most tax-favored to you, the employee, because they're going to be taxed at a lower tax bracket. They're not going to be taxed when they're granted, so you're not going to have any ordinary income taxes. And you'll see this in our case study today, where a major tax problem was being created because of the way this employee chose a particular stock option with a tech company that was working for us. So do some planning beforehand. If you rise to the level where stock options are granted, find out from your company if they have different stock option grants between investment stock option and non-qualified stock options, because both are taxed differently. You really want to get as much as possible what we call ISOs, incentive stock options, because they have the best favorable tax treatment. But unfortunately, they are limited to only $100,000 a year in stock option grants. So you need to know not only what the different options are in stock options and the tax consequences. If the company doesn't provide a qualified financial planner, then you need to seek the advice of a qualified financial planner, because it could literally cost you thousands and thousands of dollars in unnecessary income taxes based on the option that you choose. And the other thing you also need to know is the company's prospects. If obviously you work for a company, they're not doing well financially, that's also going to determine what kind of compensation package you want and when you're going to want to exercise and what kind. And also when you're heading to retirement, your own need for income. All of the things need to be thought of in advance. And another one that you really need to think through is deferred compensation. If you're a high-level executive and you've been getting these bonuses in addition to stock options and you've deferred them to a deferred compensation program, you really need to do some serious planning, because there's all kinds of advantages to planning in terms of increasing your Social Security benefits, postponing them and have those benefits grow by 8% a year until age 70, and also IRA and tax minimization strategies that you can use. So remember, two of the biggest expenses you're going to face in retirement are going to be your medical expenses and taxes. Do yourself a favor and do some planning in advance so you know when that day comes, you have picked the best plan that minimizes the least amount of taxes you're going to pay, provide you the most income to meet your retirement income benefits. Knowing all those things in advance, prior to walking into that HR office, when you start signing the papers and signing off and negotiating that exit package.
Okay, I'm an executive and I'm on a, let's pick a time here, 5 to 10 years countdown before I retire. What should I be doing? But I'm going to put a caveat in here too, if I could. Remember that a lot of times retirement comes unexpectedly due to various things. Health, sometimes as a company buy off and they have twice the staff they need, and there are layoffs or just layoffs from a company because of economic differences, and suddenly, voila, you are retired.
Yeah, I would say if I was 5 or 10 years away from a retirement, I would have a retirement plan. If the company provides a retirement planner, a financial planner, take advantage of those services. So number one, you're optimizing all the benefits that you can get from the company, whether it's deferred comp, whether it's various stock option plans, it's a 401k or profit sharing. So you understand all those plans and then start setting those plans up and coordinating them to achieve your retirement goal objectives. And John, you know, minimum, you should have one of these in place 5 years prior to retirement. Optimally, you should have one 10 years prior to retirement, because as you just mentioned, sometimes you may be going along and you're thinking, you know, I'm going to work here until I'm age 65, then I'm going to retire, apply for Social Security and Medicare. Well, guess what? Your company just got taken over, or there's a hostile takeover offer for your company. The new company that takes over starts weeding out staff, or we get into a severe recession, as many people found in, let's say, 2007 to 2009, and all of a sudden, you thought you were going to work there for another 5 years. Instead, you get laid off. So you should have, as a minimum, a plan 5 years prior to retirement. And I would say you would be better if you had a plan 10 years prior to retirement. So it gives you a longer period of time to plan for retirement, maximize your tax strategies, maximize your investment strategies, and know all your options. So in case something happens unexpectedly, a health condition, a merger, or basically a severe recession, that you're not caught out in the cold and having no plan at all, and all of a sudden you panic, you know, I really haven't thought this through and I don't know what my options are. So as a minimum, John, 5 years, best 10 years.
And as we always do here on Lifetime Income, what we try to do is take the principles we have just discussed and apply them to a real life case study. The names of the people involved have been changed to protect their privacy, but it is a real life study. It really did happen. So who are we talking about this week?
This week's case, Sam and Natalie Mello. Both Sam and Natalie are current age 47, hope to retire as soon as possible. Both are kind of health nuts that cycle, take good care of themselves. They're in excellent physical shape, and with longevity running in the family, they expect to live to age 90 or older based on longevity questionnaire that we put them through, and also family health history. Risk tolerance, I would say moderately aggressive. Investment knowledge, at best, would be moderate. They live in California. Sam works for a very, very well-known high-tech company. And Natalie is a marketing executive for a major bank. Now, they both are from the East Coast, South Carolina, and also New Jersey. And they're considering moving back to South Carolina. Now, Natalie really enjoys San Francisco, the culture, the city. So she's not really sure if she wants to give that up. Sam, on the other hand, a little bit more laid back, grew up in the South, and he wants to build a home and live on the beaches of South Carolina, ideally, with a slower pace to life. Both work crazy hours. They have no children, very successful at their work, but they're beginning to feel that sort of burnout from the long hours. I mean, both of them work 50, 60 hours a week. And they would love to retire as soon as possible. Now, currently, they're in San Francisco. They rent. They were considering buying a home in San Francisco, but anything that is decent there is well over $1 million. And John, $1 million in San Francisco is not a mansion. I mean, they could be a 1,500, 1,800 townhome. So anything that they were looking at was $1 million. And then they were also dealing with, hey, if we don't want to live here, we don't want to run the risk of buying a house. And especially as they saw the drop in housing values that accompanied the Great Recession that lasted from 2007 to 2009. But in terms of dropping real estate prices, it wasn't until 2012 that we began to stabilize in the real estate market. So they're a little bit fearful of that because they had some friends that lost money in housing, overpaid at the peak of the market, and they're basically underwater in their home. So they didn't want to do that. They were basically renting, and especially Sam's desire to move back to the South, where the cost of living is much cheaper, the pace is a little bit more relaxed. But, you know, once again, Natalie loves the culture of San Francisco. They both have restricted stock units and non-qualified stock options that create almost $100,000 a year in additional taxable income. Altogether, they had $1.8 million worth of assets, which included a substantial amount of stock option grants. And that was a major portion of their estate. They didn't own a home. Now, One of the things that we looked at, their income was about $450,000 a year. Their living expenses was $160,000, but they paid $220,000 a year in federal and state of California taxes. So their biggest expense, almost 60% of their expenses, were taxes. And a lot of that was created with the stock options that they were getting. They were non-qualified. They were taxable income as ordinary income. So there was an extra 100 grand they would get. It usually the options were granted at the end of the year, and it just mounted to an extra tax bill they had to come up with every April 15th when they filed their taxes. Now, both of them were tired of working long hours and wanted to retire to slow down. The ideal is to retire in 5 years and move to South Carolina where they have friends and family. They would like to own a home, but unsure given current market conditions and the fact they're unsure if they're going to stay or they're going to move. They also want to slow down, but have no idea when they could or even consider retiring. In the meantime, taxes are an immediate concern as they're both maxing out their 401k plans at work, which given their age, which is roughly about $18,000 a year. So that was $36,000 a year that both of them were putting into a 401k plan.
You know, this sounds like quite a challenge, although it's not uncommon where couples like different things. The wife seems to like the culture in San Francisco, and it's high-paced and very compressed, shall we say, high-packed culture, because you're always climbing over someone else to get to what you want to do. The husband, though, you know, from the South, likes a lot more laid back. I remember I lived in San Francisco for 2 years in the city, and my next assignment was out on the Mojave Desert in Victorville. And after 2 years in San Fran, it was a real relief walking out the back door of my apartment and looking across 20 miles of desert to the San Gabriel Mountains, you know, and I rather like that. So what are you going to do? Build San Francisco in the South or put a desert in San Francisco?
Well, some of the challenges that we were really looking for was the goal for both spouses. They were sort of getting burnt out with the hours that they were working. I mean, they made excellent income, but they were getting burned out. They enjoyed their lifestyle. So, you know, it's kind of like, I want to retire, but gosh, we love the lifestyle that we live. And they were unwilling to move now or at least take a lower paying job. I mean, let's say if they moved to South Carolina, there was no way that Sam or Natalie would be getting the same kind of income that they were getting in San Francisco. So that was a major challenge. And they also have the issue of both of them in good health. They go to the gym, they work out, they're cyclists, and so they're in great health. And they also have longevity that runs in the family. So I said, you retire early at age, you know, 50 or 55, you know, you guys could live another 35 or 40 years in your retirement. You know, you're going to need a lot more money. And the other thing that was really killing them was the taxes. I mean, as we talked about, their living expenses were $160,000. Their federal and state taxes in California were $220,000. So they paid more in taxes than what they spent on living, which is the case for many individuals that are professionals here in the state of California, because California has the highest income tax rate in the country.
Okay, so you had conflicting goals. Then how did you navigate your way between this?
Well, number one, because there was this lack of certainty in terms of, okay, we've decided we're going to stay here in California and live. They were unsure. And Sam seemed to be the dominant decision maker, which told me that probably South Carolina was a possibility. So we recommended don't buy something in California because, you know, we could get into a technology downturn as we saw happen at the beginning of the last decade or as we saw in the recession of 2007 and 2008. The best option for both of them, because they were, you know, age 47, is work 10 years. That would take them to age 57, retire to South Carolina. And if they can't or don't want to last that long, then move to South Carolina in 5 years and work another 5 years where, you know, the pace of living would be not as fast as it is in San Francisco. The cost of living would be much cheaper, and they could buy a house and deduct the mortgage expense as well as the property taxes. Now, what we did is we took a look at the various stock option grants that they had at the company. I said, you really need to negotiate your package and move from a non-qualified stock option grant to a ISO or investment stock option, because the tax advantages, you guys are getting killed every single year by an additional $100,000, where you're basically handing $60,000 of that $100,000 over to Uncle and the governor in taxes. So we recommended they both change to their ISO for their stock option plans. Current and future RSUs should be sold as they are vested and diversified into other investments, because a good majority, or almost 40% of their assets, were in a company stock. And so, you know, it's great when times are good and the stock is doing well. It's not so good. This is a high-flying stock. And the correction that we had last year in August and September, this stock lost more than 20-something percent of its value. And as I said, Sam, you don't want to be in a situation where you're getting close to retirement and you got all this money built up in the company stock, and all of a sudden we go through a downturn, as you saw in 2015. So we recommended that they invest that. But right now, they're currently staying put. We did get them to change their stock option grants, so that's going to eliminate that $100,000 that they both got hit every single December. They'd get these stock option grants that'd be $100,000 or sometimes even more, and that would just create a lot of extra taxable income. So they're doing that. They're still renting. They're continuing to save money, but the goal is right now, Sam and Natalie sort of going along with it, that the goal is to work another 5 years, and then 5 years, if they have enough, depending on how well the stock does, move to South Carolina, where it would be much cheaper to live, to buy a house. Whether they continue to work thereafter, once again, is going to depend on what they save, what the value of the stock is, and how well they do on investments. And the one thing that we've done is we've taken over handling the investment burden. So we're handling the investments, but still a good chunk of their estate is still the company's stock. So a lot of what happens 5 years from now, a lot of that is going to depend on the company stock that both he and his wife own.
So if you are an executive, I mean, as we had here in the case study with Sam and Natalie, having a plan is very, very important. Knowing the various benefits that are available and your expenses. In the case of Sam and Natalie, they were able to change their stock options to more favorable operations. But this has to be done 5 to 10 years before you retire. You can't just do it the day before you walk out the door.
No, and once again, as we're going to be talking with Yolanda York with Social Security, coordinating those options and the various benefit packages you have with the company, it also fits into your retirement plan in terms of when you file for Medicare, what you're going to do with Social Security. You're going to take it at full retirement age, take it early, or also allow it to compound, grow at 8% a year, because the government offers you that option if you choose not to receive it at age 66. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into the equation here, John, and it's unfortunate. A lot of people, you'd be surprised, as smart as executives are, they just get too busy with work and family. They don't think about these things until sometimes they find out it's too late.
And don't forget, as Jim just mentioned, tomorrow, the guest on the program, Yolanda York from the Social Security Administration, basics of Medicare and Social Security that you need to know. And it was interesting to note too, Jim, by the way, that she said if we don't do anything, it's going to really be in trouble by 2035. But that's conversation for tomorrow.
We'll cover that, but it's interesting that here's somebody that works for Social Security that says it's headed for trouble. By 2035, they're only going to be able to pay out 79% of benefits, but nobody's talking about this on the campaign trail. Well, we will. But anyway, we've run out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here for Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.